The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out this evening, and welcome to the Free Library. My name is Michelle Sheffer, and I'm the staff writer here at the library. And I'm really excited to be introducing Gary Steingart and A.L. Kennedy, who are two of the most inventive writers that I have read. Granta has rightly recognized both of them as among the best young novelists writing today. So before we begin this evening, please take a minute to make sure that your cell phones are silenced. And also I'd like to remind you that following tonight's event in the auditorium, there will be a book signing upstairs in the lobby. You can purchase books in the lobby courtesy of Joseph Fox Bookshop, and a portion of the proceeds will benefit the library tonight. So, on to the show. Gary Steingart has earned much critical praise and several awards, including the Stephen Crane Award for First Fiction for his heartbreaking and hilarious novels, including The Russian Debutante's Handbook, Absurdistan, which was named one of the best books of the year by several publications, and his newest, Super Sad True Love Story. A friend recommended Super Sad True Love Story to me by saying, "It's a book that made me hug myself with glee, that particular kind of glee when someone else just gets it, when someone else gets every single thing just right and knocks it out of the park with no missteps or false notes." I could say the exact same thing about A.L. Kennedy's precise and thoughtful prose. She's one of my favorite writers, and her characters stay with me and keep me thinking long after I've finished reading. She's the author of 12 award-winning works of fiction, including Indelible Acts, Paradise, So I Am Glad, and Day, which won the UK's prestigious Costa Prize. She continues to impress with her psychological fearlessness and breathtaking affection for language, the New York Times says of her latest short story collection, What Becomes. What's more, in her spare time, A.L. Kennedy is a stand-up comedian, which I just think is really awesome. So she'll be reading first this evening, followed by Gary Steingart. So ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming A.L. Kennedy and Gary Steingart.
Good evening. Good. I'm only wearing these so I can see you. And now I have seen you, I take them off. You're now in soft focus. It's much more romantic. I apologize that you can't have the same. I'm going to read from Work in Progress. I apologize for my foreign accent. I hope it's intelligible. We don't know. We don't understand it. No, it's fine. Obviously, I'm from Britain, where, you know, Tim Roth and Hugh Laurie and all the people on your television who portray psychopaths come from. Because we're good at that. So I'm going to read a little bit from Work in Progress. I'm over here to try and finish a novel, page 312 at the moment, if you have fingers and toes, cross them, that we can get further than that. So this is a fairly self-contained bit, so I won't go into the thing of explaining it. It's about love. Yeah. If you're familiar with my work, obviously, it won't go well. On the principle that nobody in my books gets to have more fun than me. Clearly, I have none. I'm sorry. I know I am sort of, you know, dressed like a small man with breasts, but I have no curves, so I'm just going with it. As I get older, it's all gone. There was very little there in the first place. Areas of me are now concave, and, you know, we just have to go with it. And try to be feminine within. Or something. Hope that somebody wants to look with it anyway. Right, I'll just read this and go away. Bless you. Love. Such a terrible word. Always demands you should be its accomplice, should comply. Can't even say it without that sense of licking, tasting, parting your lips to be open, to welcome whatever it is that slips in beneath your breath, and then you find yourself closing to keep it, mouth it, learn its needs, this invisible medicine, this invisible disease. It takes a hold. Not like sex. Sex is fine. Sex is simple. Not that it wasn't a cause for concern at the start, because I did reach it later. I was a slow learner and usually initially unsure. But then hasn't everyone been unsure? I don't think it's remotely unique to suffer those young, endless doubts. If he's kissing me, actually kissing me, which is nice, absolutely nice, even so, am I quite sure of why? Does he like me? Does he fancy me? Because I'd be hoping that both of those things is what we'll be about. Or is he kissing me the way he kisses everyone? Is he just the friendly type? Or curious? Or has he stumbled and coincidentally fallen against my mouth? Is this a misunderstanding on my part? Am I romantically mistaken? Is it only that, for example, there's something delicious on my face, my lips, possibly gravy, perhaps, as it's transcontinental jelly? It could be jelly. Is it just that he's hungry? Is this to do with jelly? I'd like this to be to do with me, but is that likely? I can't feel that's likely. Then again, what I can feel is currently blinding, incandescent, and offers no names for itself, and is eating, is swallowing all of my names for me, and the more I keep doing what we're doing, because he's still doing it too, we're doing it together, in fact, except he's doing it in the opposite direction. And this works, really works, and I wouldn't have thought that a body, anybody's body, could be that, well, entertaining. The more we do this, whatever it is, the less I know about it, the less I know about everything, and the less I am able to care about not knowing. I am perfectly happy and also evaporating. Who'd have thought? But eventually you're wholly free of thinking and can uncover all of who you are with him, touch against touch, and you make these beauties together, you and whoever he happens to be. It does seem wrong to say so, but who he is can seem slightly irrelevant. Not in a bad way, although it does sound bad. The specific identity of the gentleman does not, to be honest, matter that much. It isn't your fault. It's nearly their fault. The number of, eventually a not excessive, but still significant number of gentlemen's faults, because they have been, as it were, not that outstanding or differentiated. And therefore, in order to have any fun, any modest pleasure, you have become very differentiated. Your heart, your mind, your body, they have become discrete. You have separated into fragments that no longer communicate and which get curious and bored and stumble, but still, they're never disappointed. And sometimes you have a sense of waiting by which you are almost overwhelmed. Then again, you are not pathological or numb and bear none of the gentlemen ill will. You would smile at them in the street, be quietly fond. You would commiserate should they receive unpleasant news. But this isn't love. This is not love. This is not in any way that word. This is safe. You are safe. You are lucky and not unpleasantly confined. You are not unaware of love's complications and realize you have been spared, are sparing yourself. You get to enjoy what are not relationships, more a series of hobbies. Indoor games. So in a number of ways, all is well. Only then, for instance, just for instance, you may stand beside a man, a not unfamiliar man, and sharp and hard, and for no reason every shade of him will strike in through you, his layers and his musics and his scents, and you cannot touch him but want to, cannot respond but want to, cannot move but want to. He has, in the course of doing nothing, suspended you in want and want and want, and through you come reeling these dreadful truths that you fully intend to be proud of him, and to see him both happy and well, And you'll need him kept warm in the winter and cool when it's hot, and will let no ugly breeze come near him and no wanker be permitted to annoy. And you wish for him to be comfortable, at the very least comfortable, forever. And these are desires that ache in you deeper than sweating or bending or sucking or any of the thin and predictable memories or the fantasies that might defend you from the present, too present reality of him. The tiny idea of naming him darling is almost unsurvivably arousing, which is absurd. You are turning innocent and selfless to such a degree that if your absence would please him, you'd disappear. You would have to go. But you can't go. You couldn't go. You couldn't leave. While his voice is purring in your skull, purring and curling and thinking your thoughts, and you look at your hands and feel his fingers as if you have become each other's gloves, and the sound of his breath and when he swallows could set you falling, could take you to a place where you might weep, where you were far out of your mind, but still at home in it, at liberty inside yourself as you have never been. Many people take to this, are delighted to be lost, possessing and possessed. You are not one of these people. You were not one of these people. But yourself is bled together now, blurred and joined. He has made of you a unified need, a piece of desperation by being here and existing. Effortless. And his manner of existing means you will not be having sex with him. Which is to say, you will have sex with him, but you also will not. You will touch, will begin to touch, will slip and hold and rock and cling, will fuck, but you wouldn't, you truly wouldn't, if it wasn't entirely impossible to say what you need to in any other way. It won't be sex. It will be speaking. And God help you, it will also be admiration, tenderness, respect, this excruciating list of things which is making love. You will make love. You are in love. You weren't when he was leaning in the doorway, then he stepped over here, and you were. You are. This isn't fair. It isn't fucking fair, because you know what it will mean. You will lie down with him and be naked, not en route to the usual somethings unnecessarily undressed, irrevocably naked, stripped. You will be all skin and jolts and talking, and for goodness sake, honesty will break out. And that's when you will come unhinged, because you aren't going to leave him while he sleeps, sneak off and never come back. And you won't act as if you expect him to smother you in the night. Or that you'll wake up in a quarry later with a head injury and no shoes. And you're not going to keep it brutal and light in the morning, say, you'll call. You're going to rest unconscious in the almost unbearable mercy of his arms and want the trust of that and like it. You're going to stretch and turn into the day for more of the same and for inquiries and delicate smiles and whispers in case he's not awake, except he is awake. Why else would you be talking to him? He's awake and listening and whispering as well. And you both keep on whispering so you can still dream each other, be not yet in the world. And then you'll have breakfast when it's time for lunch. And oh, how much you will suddenly have to do. Memorizing mutual preferences, habits, frustrations, tics, and you'll discuss, you will have to discuss, God knows, futures and kittens or dogs or stealing a baby from outside a shop. You probably won't have time to make one of your own. And if not that, then certainly there will be carpets and curtains to consider and accommodation, gardens, flats, renting, mortgages, life insurance, drawing up your wills. And what if he dies before you? Then you'll be upset. And planning how many you'll have at the wedding breakfast. Although you might want something quick, a quiet affair with the cabbie who drove you in as a handy witness. I mean, why not? It could happen. It genuinely, horrifyingly might. When, Jesus Christ, you don't want to get married. Not you. Marriage, that's an institution. Since when did you want to spend life in an institution? This whole thing is unpicking you, reworking you into someone else, which means he will, in actuality, be marrying someone else. And how could you possibly cope with that? The jealousy alone would kill you. and the invading burdens, responsibilities, the claustrophobia, the shock. They are in the room with you like sump oil. They are rising to your chest, and this isn't how it should be, how you should be, because you love him. He is the closest you will get, the dearest. And surely this should not have to guarantee that being with him terrifies you more than dying, more than if you might die before him and end up making him upset. He mustn't be the man you'll never have purely because he seems to be so meant, has perfections, ends your waiting because he opens you up to the spine and doesn't hurt. So although you might beg to, you don't run. You stay and can stand with the back of your hand near enough to the back of his for you to feel him, read him, the magnificent argument of his blood, and you tremble and do nothing, and this is fine. Except then your lungs fill with dressing to please someone else and vice versa. And this doesn't choke you. It's unfamiliar. He's odd. And then there's going to the pictures together, which you're bound to try eventually. It is something you see all the time and completely normal, yet somehow a threat. And there's wanting to buy a sofa, because that's what lovers do. And you are lovers. You do. There is no saving you from it. Love. And you will end up going with him to buy the sofa and looking in lots of places and not being able to see the perfect one, when only perfection can represent your love or the decor and furnishings of your love. And eventually it's not improbable that you'll get tired. You don't want to imagine this, wouldn't wish it to be the case, but if you are both exhausted and perhaps your blood sugar is low, then it's almost inevitable that you'll fight. Perhaps not badly, but then maybe worse. And this free-floating resentment and discontent will follow after. And maybe in the final furniture shop there's also a table lamp that you don't like. You despise it. And you can't help your opinions. They are yours, and your personal expression is protected under international law. But your lover does like the lamp. That's his opinion of it. He adores it, insists it's wonderful, and this reignites your disagreement, kicks it into bitterness and rage, and additionally looses the welling of commitment and undertakings and regulations and sameness and exposure, hideous risk, and the awful heap of them is insurmountable and sweeps hard down at you, and before you can scream or prevent this, you've picked up the lamp. The tragic, frustrating, adorable, loathsome lamp, and you've hit him. You've knocked him right on his wonderful head, and he's bleeding. He's crying, and you're hitting him again. You're causing him pain and making him afraid, and it's a nightmare. You would rather shoot yourself. Although, of course, you don't have a gun. You're dangerous enough without one. And Christ knows you haven't a clue how this came about, but you are still hitting him, your darling. Because this way you won't have the new weight for the failure of everything sweet in your life, its most beautiful thing. You have instead brought it neatly to a close. You have killed him because he was far too extraordinary. You have murdered the only man that you have ever loved. And it takes a long breath to picture this, to see it, mourn it, understand. And for this and many other reasons, you should save him from yourself. You shouldn't take his hand and shouldn't kiss him. Your mouths shouldn't make and echo and make the shape of love. But you do take his hand and you do kiss him. Of course.
Thank you. That was wonderful. Can we have another round of applause? That was just so beautiful. Wow. I will never fall in love again. ever. Thank you so much for coming in the middle of what I think is a tornado, right? Is that what's happening? Eastern Seaboard is a hearty place. People want their literature, and they'll come out for it. I'll be reading from Super Sad True Love Story, my new book, which has an exciting cover that tested well with the youth market. If you have a dachshund shear, he can play Twister on this. And I know many of you do. Very exciting. I'm glad to be back in Philly. It's been years, well, months, weeks. But anyway, it's great to be back. I'll be reading from Super Sad. This is one of these books that requires some explanations before you start reading. It's not science fiction, don't worry. It's set slightly in the future when a completely illiterate America is about to fall apart. So, next Tuesday. There's a ruling party called the Bipartisan Party. Isn't that nice when you don't have to worry about which party to choose? There's just the Bipartisan Party. And it's under the leadership of Defense Secretary Rubenstein, my first Jewish strongman. Whenever I write a book, my father calls me and says, is this book going to be good for the Jews? And I always say, I don't think this is going to be good for anybody. Jews, Koreans, Scottish people, nobody wins, you know. In this future, a device called the apparat is worn by everyone. It's a little pendant, and what it does is it immediately ranks you. So if you enter a room, let's say I go to a bar, immediately everyone ranks me, and I know that I'm, let's say, the seventh ugliest man in the room, but I have the 14th best credit rating or something like that. And the main characters are the Russian-American Lenny Abramov. He's the narrator of this section, and he's approaching his 40s. He works for a company called Post-Human Services, which is trying to find a cure for death. And he has a younger Korean-American girlfriend called Eunice Park. And Lenny likes to read books, which is very verboten in this society. Today in Center City, I eat a Korean taco. Eh? Multiculturalism lives. Very good. The next day, Eunice and I took the Long Island Railroad to Westbury, Long Island, to meet my parents, the Abramovs. The love I felt for Eunice on that train ride had a capital and provinces, parishes, and a Vatican, an orange planet, and many sullen moons. It was systemic, and it was complete. Eunice was nervous almost to the point of quaking. Her outfit was conservative for the occasion, a sky blue blouse with a Peter Pan collar and white buttons, pleated wool skirt reaching down below the knees, a black ribbon tied around the neck. From certain angles, she resembled one of the Orthodox Jewish women who have overrun my co-op building. There she was, sweating so handsomely on her orange pleather LIRR seat. Her elder worship and elder fear brought out a strange immigrant pride in me. There was something else, too. It was on the Long Island Railroad some 20 years ago that I had had my first crush on a Korean girl. I'd been a freshman at a prestigious math and science high school in Tribeca. Most of the other kids were Asian, and although technically you had to live within New York City to go to the school, there were more than a few of us who faked our residency and commuted from various parcels of Long Island. For me, the long ride to Westbury amidst dozens of fellow nerd students was a particularly difficult one because it was public knowledge at the science high school that my weighted average was a dismal 86.894, while at least 91.553 had been recommended for entry into Cornell or the University of Pennsylvania, the weakest of the Ivy League schools. Oh, yeah, I realize the relevance here. As immigrant children from high-performing nations, we knew our parents would slap us across the mouth for anything less than Cornell. Several of the Korean and Chinese boys who took the railroad with me, their spiky hair still haunts my most literal dreams, would dance around me singing my average. 86.894, 86.894. You won't even get into Oberlin with that, they said. Have fun at NYU, Abramov. Yeah, see you at the University of Chicago. It's the teacher of teachers. But there was one girl, another Eunice, a Eunice Choi to be exact, a tall, quiet beauty. He would pry the boys away from me while shouting, it's not Lenny's fault he can't do well in school. Remember what Reverend Sung says in church. We're all different. We all have different abilities. Remember the fall of man? We're all fallen creatures. And then she'd sit down with me and unbidden help me with my impossible chemistry homework, moving the strange letters and numbers around my notebook until the equations were for some reason deemed balanced, while I utterly unbalanced by the magical girl next to me, her skin glowing beneath her summer gym shorts and orange Princeton jersey, tried to catch a brief smell of her hair or a brush of her hard elbow. It was the first time a woman had risen up to defend me, had given me the idea that I actually should be defended, that I wasn't a bad person, just not as skilled at life as some others. At Westbury Unison, I disembarked before an armored personnel carrier sitting by the squat station house, its 50-caliber Browning gun bouncing up and down. National Guardsmen were surveying the diverse crowd, Salvadorans and Irish and South Asians and Jews and whoever else had chosen to make this corner of central Long Island the rich, smelly tapestry it had now become. The troops appeared angrier and more sunburned than usual. Perhaps they had just been rotated out of Venezuela. We're fighting in Venezuela at this point. It's not going well. Beside the armored personnel carrier, a sign read, "It is forbidden to acknowledge the existence of this armored personnel carrier, the object." By reading the sign, you've denied existence of the object, an implied consent. We took a cab to the corner of Washington Avenue and Myron, the most important corner of my life. I could already see my parents' brownish half-brick, half-stucco cape, the golden mailbox out in front, the faux 19th-century lamp beside it, the cheap lawn chair stacked on the island of cement that was supposed to be the front porch, and the gigantic flags of the United States and Israel billowing from two flagpoles. I felt a little embarrassed because I knew that Eunice's parents were much better off than mine. At the door, my mother appeared in her usual household outfit, white bra and panties. She was about to throw her arm around my neck when she noticed Eunice let out some Russian garble of amazement and retreated inside the house, leaving me with the visuals of her thick breasts and white little round of belly. My father, shirtless, soon took her place, also gasped at Eunice, ran his hand against his naked, muscular breasts, said, "Whoa," then hugged me. There was hair against my new dress shirt, the gray carpet of hair that my father wore with an odd touch of class, as if he were a royal in some tropical country. He kissed me on both cheeks, and I did the same, feeling the instructions, the code of Russian father-son relations. Father means I have to love him, have to listen to him, can't offend him, can't hurt him, can't bring him to task for past wrongs. He's an old man now, defenseless. My mother reappeared in shorts and a wife beater. "Sinochek, little son," she shouted. "Look who's come to us, nash lubimits, our favorite." She shook Eunice's hand, and both of my parents swiftly evaluated her, affirmed that she was, like her predecessors, not Jewish, but quietly approved of the fact that she was thin and attractive with a healthy black mane of hair. My mother unwrapped her own precious blonde locks from the green handkerchief that kept them safe from the American sun and smiled prettily at Eunice. She began talking in her brave post-retirement English about how glad she was to have a potential daughter-in-law, filling in the contours of her loneliness with rapid-fire questions about my mysterious life in faraway New York. "Does Lenny keep clean house? Does he vacuum? Once I come to college dormitorium. Och, awful, such smell. Dead ficus tree, old cheese on table, socks hanging in the windows." Eunice smiled and spoke in my favor. "He's very good, Mrs. Abramov," she said. "He's very, very clean." I looked at her with love. Somewhere beneath the bright suburban skies, I felt the presence of a 50-caliber Browning gun swiveling toward an incoming Long Island Railroad train. But here I stood, surrounded by the people who loved me. "I brought Tagamet from the discount pharmacy," I said to my father, taking 5 boxes out of the bag I brought. "Thank you, Malinki, little one," my father said, taking hold of his beloved drug. "It's peptic ulcer," he said to Eunice, pointing at the depth of his tortured stomach. My mother had already grabbed hold of the back of my head and was madly stroking my hair. "So gray," she said. "So old he gets, almost 40. Leonia, what is happening to you? Too much stress? Also losing hair. Oh, my God." "You are named Eunice," my father said. "Do you know where it comes from, such name?" "My parents," Eunice gamely began. "No, it's from the Greek, eunike, meaning victorious." He laughed, happy to demonstrate that before he was forced to be a janitor in America, he had served as a quasi-intellectual and minor dandy on Moscow's Arbat Street. "So I hope," he said, "that in life you will be victorious also." "Who cares about Greek, Boris?" my mother said. "Look at how she's beautiful." The fact that my parents admired Eunice's looks and capacity for victory brightened me quite a bit. all these years and I still crave their approval, still long for the carrot and stick of their 19th century child rearing. I instructed myself to lower the heat of my emotions, to think without the family blood bursting at my temples, but I was 12 years old as soon as I passed the mezuzah at the front door. My father began to lead me to the living room couch for our usual heart-to-heart. My mother rushed over to the couch with a garbage bag, which she draped over the place where I was about to sit in my compromised Manhattan outerwear. She took Eunice to the kitchen, chatting gaily to her potential daughter-in-law about how guys can be so dirty, you know, and how she had just built a new storage device for her many mops. On the couch, my father draped his arm around my shoulders and said, "Ну, расскажи, so tell me." I breathed in the same breath as he did, as if we were connected. I felt his age seep into mine as if he were the forward guard of my own mortality. I spoke in English with the tantalizing hints of Russian I had studied haphazardly at NYU, the foreign words like raisins shining out of a loaf. I spoke about work, about my assets, about the most recent fairly positive valuation of my 740-square-foot Manhattan apartment, about all the monetary things that kept us fearful and connected. He held up the new apparat pendant I wore around my neck. "How much?" he said, turning the thing over, colorful data and rankings pouring over his hairy fingers. When I explained that the device was given to me at work, he made a happy snort and said in English, "Aha, learn new technology for free. It's good." The floor beneath my feet was clean, immigrant clean, clean enough so that you understood that somebody had done their best. My father had two old-fashioned television screens stapled to the walls above my mother's fanatically waxed mantelpiece. There's only two stations left in the country. There's Fox Liberty Prime and Fox Liberty Ultra, so. You have quite a nice choice there. One television was set to a Fox Liberty Prime stream, which was showing the growing tent city in Central Park, the homeless people now spreading from the backyard of the Metropolitan Museum over Hill and Dale all the way down to the Sheep's Meadow. On the other screen, Fox Liberty Ultra was viciously broadcasting the arrival of the Chinese central banker at Andrews Air Force Base, our president and his pretty wife trying not to shiver in the bleak Maryland downpour. I felt my father's breath against my cheek for 20 minutes as he talked about news on the Fox and his complex political life, then excused myself, unwound from his humid embrace, and went to the upstairs bathroom as my mother shouted to me from the kitchen, "Lenny, don't take shoes off in upstairs bathroom. Papa has grybok, athlete's foot." In the contaminated bathroom, I admired the strange blob of plastic with wooden spokes that kept my mother's serious mop collection in ready-to-access mode. Although my parents never had a good word to say about the country now known as Holy Petrol Russia, the hallways were hung with framed sepia-toned postcards of Red Square and the Kremlin, the snow-dusted equestrian statue of Prince Yuri Dolgoruki, founder of Moscow, and the Gothic Stalin-era skyscraper of prestigious Moscow State University, which neither of my parents had attended because, to hear them tell it, Jews were not allowed in back then. As for me, I have never been to Russia. I have not had the chance to learn to love it and hate it like my parents. I have my own dying empire to contend with, and I do not wish for any other. My bedroom was nearly empty. All the traces of my habitation, the posters and little bits of crap from my travels were gone. I reveled in the smallness, the coziness of an upstairs bedroom in a traditional American Cape Cod house, that half floor that forces you to duck, that forces you to feel small and naive again. I cannot begin to tell you how much the purchase of this house, of each tiny bedroom, had meant to my family and to me. I still remember the signing at the real estate lawyer's office, the three of us mentally forgiving each other for a decade and a half worth of sins, the youthful beatings administered by my father, my mother's anxieties and manias, my own teenage sullenness, because the janitor and his wife had done something right at last. And it would all be okay now. There was no turning back from this glorious fortune we had been granted in the middle of Long Island. From the carefully clipped bushes by the mailbox, our bushes, Abramov bushes, to the often-mentioned Californian possibility of an above-ground swimming pool in the tiny backyard. Down in the dining room with the shiny Romanian furniture the Abramovs had imported from their Moscow apartment, the table was laid out in the hospitable Russian manner with everything from four different kinds of salami to a plate of chewy tongue to every little fish that had ever inhabited the Baltic Sea, not to mention the sacred little dash of black caviar. Eunice sat, Queen Esther-like in her orthodox getup, at the ceremonial end of the table upon a fluffed-up Passover pillow, frowning at the attention, unsure of how to deal with the strange currents of love and its opposite that circulated in the fish-smelling air. My father proposed a seasonal toast in English. To the Creator, he said, who created America, land of free, and who gives us Defense Secretary Rubenstein, who kills Arab. And to love, which is blooming in such time between my son and Eunike, who, big wink to Eunice, will be victorious like Sparta over Athens. And to the summer, which is most conducive season to love, although some may say spring. While he went on in his booming voice, a shot glass shaking in his troubled hand, my mother, bored out of her mind, leaned over to me and said, «Кстати, у твоей Юнис очень красивые зубы. Может быть, ты женишься? By the way, your Юнис has very pretty teeth. Maybe you will marry her». I could see Eunice's mind absorbing the basics of my father's speech. Arabs, bad. Jews, good. Chinese central banker, possibly okay. America, always number one in his heart. While she gauged the intent on my mother's face as she spoke to me in Russian. Eunice's mind moved so quickly through feelings and ideas, but the fear on her face reflected a life rushing by faster than she could make sense of it. The toast finally complete, we dove into the food without reservation. All of us from countries historically strangled by starvation, none of us strangers to salt and brine. Eunice, my mother said, perhaps you can answer for me this question. Who is Lenny by profession? I never can figure out. He went to NYU business school, so he's like what, businessman? Mama, I said, please, not now, not now. I am talking to Eunice, my mother said. You know, girls talk. I'd never seen Eunice's face so serious, even as the tail end of a Baltic sardine disappeared between her glossy lips. Well, Lenny does very important work, she told my mother. It's, I think, like medicine? Like, he helps people live forever? My father's fist slammed the dining table. Impossible, he cried. It breaks every law of physics and biology, for one. For two, it's immoral against God. I would not want such thing, too. Work is work, my mother said. If stupid rich American wants to live forever and Lenny makes money, why do you care? She waved her hand at my father. Stupid, she said. Yes, but how Lenny knows about medicine, my father lit up, brandishing a fork capped by a marinated mushroom. He never studied in high school. What is his weighted average? 86.894. My mother waved him off again and turned to Eunice. So you met Lenny in Italy, she said. Lenny tells us you speak perfect Italian. Eunice blushed some more. No, she said, lowering her eyes and cupping her knees. I'm forgetting everything, the irregular verbs. Now, Lenny spends 1 year in Italy, my father said. We come to visit him. He speaks nothing. Blah, 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 blah. He moved his body to imitate my walking through the Roman streets while trying to talk to the natives. You are a liar, Boris, my mother said casually. He bought this beautiful tomato in market. He brought down price 3 euro. But tomato is so simple, my father said. In Russian, pomidor. In Italian, pomodoro. Even I know such thing. If he maybe negotiates for us cucumber or squash. Заткнись уже, Боря. Shut up already, Boris, my mother said. She readjusted her summer blouse and bored her eyes into mine. Lenny, she said, we see you appear on Apparat Stream, 101 people we need to feel sorry for. Why do you do it? Your colleague, he makes fun of you. He says you are fat and stupid and old. You don't eat good food and you do not have profession and your fuckability rankings are very low. Also, he says тебя понизили. You've been demoted at the company for which you work. Papa and I are very sad about this. My father looked away in some shame while I curled and uncurled my toes beneath the table. I told him so many times not to look at any apparat streams or data about me. I was a private person with my own little world. Why couldn't they find a better use for their retirement years than this painful scrutiny of their only child? Why did they stalk me with their tomatoes and high school averages and who are you by profession logic? And then I heard Eunice speak, her straightforward American English ringing against the smallness of our house. I told him not to appear in it too, she said. And he won't anymore. You won't, right, Lenny? You're so good and smart, like, why do you need to do it? Exactly, my mother said. Exactly, Eunice. I did not say anything. I leaned back and watched the two women in my life look across a glossy Romanian table groaning beneath a plastic cover and 20 gallons of mayonnaise and canned fish. They were eyeing each other with a placid understanding. Sometimes mothers and girlfriends compete against one another, but that has never been my experience. It is quite easy for two smart women, no matter what the gap in their age and background, to come to a complete agreement about me. This child, they seem to be saying to each other, this child still needs to be brought up. Thank you.
Sometimes silence is better than a Q&A, but let's see how we do. The way this works is you put your hand up, I'll call on you, we'll get a mic to you, and who would like to start us off? Gentleman right in front.
This question is for Mr. Stangard. I'm curious what Lenny sees in Eunice and what kind of his motivations for being with her. If you could.
Yeah, I mean, maybe even a better question is, is this on? Can you hear me? Yeah.
Should be.
Another question maybe, what does Eunice see in Lenny?
Yeah, that was
39-year-old man, which is in this society is considered dead, basically. He has a bald spot shaped like the great state of Ohio, with a mole exactly where the capital of Columbus is. And he works, you know, very little that attracts the... What he sees in her is very simple. She's young. She's beautiful. He doesn't want to die, and he wants to continue that. What they both see in each other is the fact that they are from truly dysfunctional immigrant families, and this is something they can really recognize in each other, and the hope is that they can, you know, fix each other's problems, that there's a sense of empathy between them. But ultimately, I think as the book continues, what happens is the choices they have to make, the Sophie's choices they have to make, sort of revolve around whether to stick to choose their families or to choose each other. And that's something that happens in many immigrant setups. Not mine, though.
Another question? Back here on the aisle.
Gary, I almost hesitate to bring this up, but are you familiar with the incident that happened up in Rutgers in the last day or two?
No, what happened?
Oh, okay. Well, some sort of cyber competition ended up with a 18-year-old freshman jumping off the GW bridge because his intimate encounter with another young man was shown on the web by his roommate.
Yeah.
It appears the bounds of cyber competition are so degraded that they get amusement by violating the sanctity or the privacy of another human being. This all comes about at the same time that your characters are so skilled at their digital and cyber connectedness. I wonder about your comments about this.
Yeah, no, I just read about that very groggily this morning on the intertube. On the New York Times website. It's a tragedy beyond, you know, I mean, it's just unbelievable what has happened. And look, I think people were bullied before the internet, and this just adds a much more, well, it adds the terrifying twist that you're not just bullied in front of 5-10 people, but in front of the entire world. What shocks me also is how simple it is for people to let go of their privacy. You know, this has been happening very rapidly. The internet has only come about in the last 10 years, really, and we're all, a part of us is becoming less analog. I think each year scientists say I lose about 6% of my humanity, you know, because I'm becoming more app than man as this continues. And I think that the tragic thing is that we're not, it's, you know, I'm on the Facebooking thing too. I upload pictures of dachshunds and stuff like that. That's not as horrifying, obviously, as this, the worst scenario that you talked about. But what we're all doing is we're all saying that the ultimate approval of who we are comes from the internet and from this giant hive mind. And I don't want to speculate about what happened to this poor young man, but I'm sure that was a part of it, that this feeling of being exposed in this way. But what was going on, what was more interesting to me, is what was going on in the minds of those two people, that his erstwhile colleagues who committed this horrible offense. You know, they obviously didn't realize that it would lead to this, but at the same time, you know, the kind of degradation of one's concept of what it means to be a human being and what it means to value another person's privacy. It's absolutely shocking.
Yeah, twice.
No, I'm sorry. I'm making my way through a super sad true love story, and I'm really enjoying it. I really like how Global Teens is sort of like Facebook, and Eunice is talking to her friend. I guess they're emailing each other, and the friend is outraged that she was at a party and some girl came over to her and verbaled her, like, "How dare you?" just talking to somebody. But I really love that part where, you know, you were talking about the loss of privacy, and Lenny Abramoff is on this list, you know, 101 people we need to feel sorry for. And he's like, "Oh, that was really nice. That guy added me to the list." And Eunice is like, no, it's bad. You got to get off of that thing.
Sir, do you have a specific question?
That's a good point.
I think this is great. You know, I can stick with this for about an hour. Yeah. Tell me other things you like. It's good.
I'm just going to read from the book briefly.
Please.
I'll leave you alone.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, people always ask, you know, is this book, how close is this book to reality? I had a waitress at a downtown restaurant who said, "Did I verbal you my order?" You know, and I thought, "Sweetheart, I love you. You're going in. You know, you're going into the book." NYU had a seminar for incoming students on how to talk to people without using Facebook. So, you know, it'd be a, "Hey," they'd say, "Why don't you ask her where she's from?" And it's, you know, "So where are you from?" "I'm from Scotland." "Okay, I'm from Long Island." And they were so shocked that you could talk to each other without actually using the Facebook. And that was a freshman orientation. So everything I'm writing about in this book, I think, is very, very close to reality. And then I'd teach at the Columbia University for special people in uptown New York. And so I would just sit down on the campus and listen to people talk. And that's where I got some of the abbreviations I made up, like Timatov, which is what Eunice says to Lenny, is, "I think I'm about to openly vomit." And then there's JBF, which just means, "I'm just butt fucking you." It's just a kind of nice way to say, "I'm kidding." But there's other stuff that I got from just listening to, like, Rolf Larp, that actually exists. It means, "I'm rolling on the floor laughing at addictive rodent pornography." So the world is so brave and so new. Actually, I'm not even sure it's a world, but it's brave and new. And thank you for your comments.
Lady in the middle here. Could you please wait for the mic? She'll be right to you.
Philly's a town of people who just... You
know. I haven't read the book yet, but I heard you on the radio, on NPR, and I want to know the apparat, like this necklace he's wearing, is that something that his employer makes him wear, or does everybody in the country have to wear one of them?
With the data on it,
around his neck.
In the book, everyone wears one because you have to be ranked all the time, except for the very rich, those HNWIs, high net worth individuals, who actually know who they are and don't have to wear an apparat. But everyone else has to have one at all times, otherwise. And the more extroverted you are, the more you tell about yourself, the higher your personality rankings are, not to mention your fuckability rankings, and then your sustainability rankings. So it's a very difficult ecosystem, but it's one that Lenny, as a 39-year-old, has a lot of trouble navigating. To learn about Facebooking, the intertube, all this stuff, I hired an intern, a male intern, a very beautiful male intern. My female friends all call him my man-tern, and he's, they're making an HBO series about him. But Manturn, you know, Manturn helped me understand all this stuff, and he got me the iTelephone, and we and, you know, before that, all I had was a Hotmail account, which I don't know how it is in the UK, but here it's just, it's not good. What was the question? I don't, whatever. I hope I answered it. Yeah.
You know what? Let's just change gears a little bit. We were talking backstage. Gary, I wasn't talking to you about this, but Allison, we were. Just sort of about the new patronage that there seems to be, or not new patronage, but folks who have money who invite writers to their homes to write. And it just seems like an old phenomenon is coming full circle. And I wonder if, I know it's something that you've experienced too, Gary.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of weird coming to, I'm in the States quite often, but it's kind of odd. You know, hearing people talking about Oh, just all that human contact stuff. You know, because I come from a culture where we were never able to speak to each other, you know. So, this is not a new thing. You don't. It's amazing there are Scottish people, because how we get it to... some kind of weird thing. I think it's swimming, communal swimming in the spring. It's like salmon. It's how we reproduce. So... yeah, I mean, obviously over here you have colony things like Yaddo and that kind of place where you get a big bunch of people reenacting The Shining, but as a communal experience, which I never really fancied. But yeah, I mean, if you can get, I have a gig over in New York where I stay in somebody's house who has a summer house in the grounds of their house, which is the house that they live in when they're not living in the other house, which is quite close to the other house. Which is sort of repulsive, but also really nice, because you can sit and you suddenly realize why, you know, Dickens and Chekhov and all of these people got quite a lot of work done, because they weren't shopping, cleaning, cooking, or doing anything, because everything gets done. So you can actually work. But again, the setup in the UK is it's sort of Canadian. We have government funding for the arts. We used to, sorry. We now don't have any funding for the arts. But I think it's difficult. I was talking to somebody in Montreal about this. It's difficult to get the very wealthy, bless them, to put money into something that's as unpromising as writers. I mean, you know, you get like I don't know, we could put their photograph on the cover, maybe, but it's not like you have a piece of art. People with incredible amounts of money, you know, they're willing to buy, you know, like a fake antique, as long as it's very valuable. They don't really mind if it got stolen in the middle of the night from somewhere terrible that they weren't meant to go ever, or if it's a reproduction of that. But it's quite difficult to get the wealthy to invest in letters. I don't know where that fell off, the idea that intellectual activity should be supported. It's funny, I was looking at the big mural outside the Rockefeller Center with the strange 1930s mosaic people, and there's poverty at one end and everybody's burning and falling down a hole, which is quite right, that's what poverty does, and there's ignorance over there and they're burning and falling down a hole because that's what ignorance does, and in the middle it's like poetry and stuff and all this stuff, and you're going, but nobody believes this anymore. What do you know, there's a man in sort of strange gay shorts who's next to poetry. And you just it's never really been sexy in a good way, has it? People in robes. No. I mean, it is the remedy to everything, and it stops you being lonely, and it stops you being sociopathic, and it enriches your life, and it makes you change everything because you change the story of yourself, and it's hugely powerful. That's why they lock up poets, dictators and people, not because they're irritating. But yeah, it's hard to get the wealthy to put money into it, and if they don't, who will? Because we don't make any money at all. I'm wearing everything I own.
In this layers. Book is going to change that, though.
Yeah. But he goes to Italy. But that's a communal one, isn't it? There's more than one writer.
There's a lot of the Italian aristocracy is wonderful. Some of the older Italian aristocracy still hasn't heard the news that people have stopped reading books. So they're very excited to host writers. You know, they're incredibly... and you're sort of like telling them the news of the world. You know, they ask you questions like, Gary, Salman Rushdie, is he Jewish? And they'll say, no, he's Indian. Ah, but he's so ugly. And that works on so many levels.
Well, thank goodness there's still some patronage. Another question. A gentleman on the aisle there.
It seems to me that you, even though you're writing novels, they sound to me more like short stories. Would you please comment on that?
As I say, I tend to read things that are self-contained so that I don't have to do the thing that you have to do. Reading if you're a poet, it's fine. You do the, here's the next one, and 3 minutes whiz by, and that's it, and it's self-explanatory. If you're reading from a novel, I hate doing the thing if you stand up and you give the 25-minute explanation about how Harriet got divorced from Edward, and Edward is now living with Cynthia, and Cynthia has a wooden leg, which you need to know for the paragraph 6 on page 15, which you'll be getting to later, and Frederick was frightened by a moose, and that will come up. Is why when somebody says antlers, he twitches. It drives me crazy. So I tend to read things that are very sealed units, so that I just do. Here's the thing. There aren't many sealed units, so sometimes you can't in a book. That's about the only one in that book. But no, hopefully my aim with a novel would be that it would not be a short story, because that would not be good. That would be too short. Or even lots of short stories glued together, that would also be a failure. But who knows? I'm a Calvinist. I always expect to fail. In a new and interesting way. And I haven't failed in that way yet, so that may be the one for this book. It's my book 13. So, yeah, I'm expecting that the manuscript, I'll just be putting it into the mailbox and it will fall and kill me. If I'm lucky, really. Maybe it won't fall and kill me, it'll come out. And I'll read the reviews and it'll be just a short story. It's just very long. Has the lack of depth of a short story, and it goes on forever.
Gary, you want to give it a try? The short story question?
Oh, I don't write short stories. They're too hard. Chekhov wrote a good short story. I love Lady with Lapdog. Big questions about who the lapdog was. A lot of people think it was a terrier, but... Jack Russell Terriers and I have this long-standing war. So I want to think it's a dachshund. And I knew Chekhov had a dachshund, but it was a very difficult relationship because the dachshund was ill. Many dachshunds have back problems, but Chekhov also had back problems. So in many cases, the dachshund had to lift Chekhov up and carry him across Yalta. And this was really ridiculous because it's a dachshund, you know. But this is what dogs do for their writers.
But a bed of 24 dachshunds can support you.
Yeah. A herd of dachshunds.
Really very well.
And they all won the MacArthur Fellowship together. It was kind of...
It was moving. That's why Ole Knipper fell in love with him as he glided past.
Yeah. There goes Chekhov again. Physician, heal thyself.
Do we have any animal-related questions out there? Anybody? Lady in the middle, me, rust-colored shirt.
This is for Miss Kennedy. It's so much fun to see you again. You were here once with Roddy Doyle, and I really enjoyed it when you were here before, and you're just as funny. But I just want to ask, what's... The difference about writing your novel here or your book here versus writing in I guess, Scotland? Is that where you're writing when you're writing at home?
Kind of. I just don't seem to live at home anymore. I mainly live on trains, which is as unpleasant as you would know from here. It's exactly the same over there. They never go anywhere, and the food is frightening. We were discussing the Amtrak hot dogs earlier.
There's one in me now.
Yeah. You don't hear that often. I'm not home very often. The thing about writing in America is the time difference means that people can't annoy me and people don't ask me to do things for free. And it's the same as over here. There are no journalists anymore, so all writers everywhere get phoned 4 times a day to say, can you please write 100 words on me? And we won't pay you, and it'll fill the newspaper because we're phoning 80 people to do that today, none of whom are journalists and none of whom will pay. Please, you know, please tell us about your favorite food. Do I look like I have a favorite food? Do I look like I would enjoy anything? You know, or like Vogue, for crying out. Vogue? No. Vogue phoned up and said, you know, just talk about anything. Just like, you know, if you have a talismanic pair of shoes. What does that even mean? And I meant I had to have my photograph taken outside Vogue's offices with everybody going past going.
No.
She's standing in for whoever should be having a... What goes on? No, it just means I get peace, and I live in a wooden house in the woods, surrounded, I have to say this time, by, I've been there 10 years, this has never happened, downy woodpeckers everywhere. They're eating the house. They're beautiful, but I thought initially it was like, God, there's a fire. You know, because it's out in the country, and it's like, Jim Bob's fallen down the well, and he just goes... And they're a big hole, big as the woodpecker. That's unnecessary. I said, what are you going to do? You're going to crawl in there and live? And it's, no, there's nothing in there that you could eat. So I'm having a war with them. Not in a bad way. I love them. They're very cute. But, yeah, I go slightly stir-crazy, don't wear enough clothes sometimes. And it's just me and the birds and the typing. So 200 pages in ornithology. And I have one record, which is Are You Experienced, which is nice, but it's probably a bit too much of Jimi Hendrix. With the sort of... Excuse me while I kiss the... Oh, Jimmy, it's all gone wrong. I was in his house. He lived... I'm sorry, we killed him. He died in London. But I was in his house about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago. No, 5 years. I've been away for so long, I can't remember. I was in his house, and there's still the staircase that everybody fell down. They just take you upstairs and say, this is the staircase that Keith Moon and Ginger Baker and Eric Clapton and all the Beatles and most of the Stones and the Kinks fell down. It's just this. All the staircase was there for was to make rock icons fall down it. That's it. That's the only bit that's left that was there when he was there. Just in case you wanted to.
Shall we move on? One or two more questions, and then we'll wrap it up. Gentleman in the black in the middle there, and then we'll head back on my right.
Ms. Kennedy, you mentioned as you're imagining the encounter, the first person is imagining the encounter with man, you wondering whether he would fall against you, his mouth would actually touch your lips, or whether he would lick you, your face, your lips, as if he were hungry, reminded me of something I read recently about, it's commonly believed that when a dog jumps up and licks you in the face, it's he's showing extreme affection. But in fact, what the dog is doing is acting out some ancient instinct of hunger. He smells some food you ate a while ago. I'm wondering whether some thought like this went into you writing that.
Oh, where to begin? In a lovely, well, I'm fond of, we're both fond of dogs to an unnatural degree, I feel. There are some men you just want to go, good thick ear in a gentleman, thick warm ear is more attractive than, and if they do things wrong, you just bite them gently on the ear. It's the only thing that works, I find. With the kind of men that find me attractive. It's just, speaking to them doesn't work. You just bite them like I used to do when I had an Irish setter. They don't obey you. They just agree with you occasionally. I don't know. I mean, I know that dogs, because when dogs are baby dogs, their parents chew meat and then they put the meat into the baby dog's mouth. I wouldn't really insist that anybody did that if I was hungry, really. I don't know. It's a confusing area because there's lots of eating and biting and rolling about and making odd noises, and the whole thing is ludicrous if you think about it, which you shouldn't. Although if all you can do is think about it, then obviously you do, and then you think, and it's ridiculous, so you never do because you've thought about it. I think. Yeah, but no, I mean, I don't think guys are sort of vulpine or anything. It's very difficult. I mean, I have spent... about the last week trying to do the ultimate in the sense of not the penultimate love scene, it's just the end, you know, it's the last time they will do that to each other in the book, And it's just difficult. And you spend, you know, I just spent 3 days trying to have a gentleman insert, not the obvious thing, but another part of himself into somewhere interesting that she might have liked. And there's no way to say that, really. And you're sitting on a series of trains just thinking, how do I say this? Because people do it and people, you know, hope that it would please each other. But it's very difficult to not make it because the woman is quite often receiving. It's very difficult, although you don't necessarily, you know, having been in the female position, you don't feel passive, but you sort of are being passive, but you're trying not to make it passive. But you're also trying not to make the guy too, you know, there's manly, and then there's the sort of wolfy, werewolfy, rare thing, which is just quite cliched. And not that much fun. I'm just rambling. I know nothing about this. But no, I've never really thought of gentlemen as a vulpine or a canine in that way. But, you know, you're being mother and child and father, and there's probably some livestock in there as well. You're just going through your variations so you can be everybody you could be, just in case, you know, he or she likes one of them. And that's kind of fun. Sorry, you're all going to strike me off your Twitter list now, which is the only thing I do.
Gary, canine effects on your literature?
I can't talk about my canine love to audiences. Senator Rick Santorum was in one audience of mine, and things got very, very ugly. Sorry, that's a reference that's
why
very
we voted
Pennsylvanian.
Him out.
But now that he's out of office, I do love dogs. I love kissing dogs. And I love hugging dogs and petting them. They sleep with me and stuff. Yeah.
Final question. In back on the right, lady in the red.
I did see the very funny video that you made with the Columbia student. Or I think that they were Columbia students. And I was just wondering if you wrote that, or who inspired coming up with a video. It was very funny.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I have a trailer. So you can't sell a book anymore without making a film about it first. And my trailer was about, it starred James Franco. Muy caliente. But no less caliente were Jeff Eugenides, Jay McInerney, Mary Gateskill, the dog. There's a beautiful wiener dog in it. Felix the wiener dog. Who else was it? Oh, Edmund White. He's so funny. Edmund White is brilliant. So the conceit of the trailer was that I never learned how to read, despite teaching at Columbia. So parts of it, you know, I'm just running around going, I can't read. The way it came to me was actually at Yaddo. We were talking about, you know, fancy American colonies, writers' colonies. And it was the middle of winter. It was very cold. I was bored out of my mind and drunk out of my mind. And there were other things besides. So one day I woke up and I said, oh, damn it, I'm going to make the best trailer ever. Because book trailers can be so pretentious and annoying. You know, there's always like a stream and a brook, and the authors, most authors don't want to do this. You know, they're sort of corralled to do it by their publisher. So I thought, I just woke up, I thought, illiteracy, James Franco, me, you know. And we filmed it in a month, and it has, I think, close to 100,000 hits, and has been responsible for a lot of the good sales of this book. Because, the moment it appeared, I was walking down the street of Manhattan, and some guy's like, I know you, you're that dude who can't read good. And I knew we had hit gold.
Gary Steingart, A.L. Kennedy.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.